Mint is still $15 a month for premium wireless. And if you haven't made the switch yet, here are 15 reasons why you should. One, it's $15 a month. Two, seriously, it's $15 a month. Three, no big contracts. Four, I use it. Five, my mom uses it. Are you playing me off? That's what's happening, right? Okay, give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. It is 1994. Xi'an, a city in China, the People's Republic of China, undergoing a transformation from a poverty-damaged culture, 5,000-year-old culture, poverty-damaged by geopolitics and the insistence on the Chinese Communist Party to brutalize the population in the 50s and 60s and 70s. And here we are, 1994. And the author, Anne Stevenson Yang, has returned to China. She was there once before as an editorialist, returned to China, representing a business council, and she's invited to Xi'an's presentation of business and business and manufacturing and development. And she arrives and is ushered into the hall and taken upstairs, and there's a velvet curtain, and it pulls back. And congratulations. A very good evening to you. Thank you for this. The book is Wild Ride, A Short History of the Opening and Closing of the Chinese Economy. You are privileged to have witnessed the 5 decades you preview for us here and then analyze. And this is 1994, so it's the second decade of the Chinese miracle. The velvet curtain pulls back. And what do you see and what do you do next? Good evening to you, Anne.
Good evening, John. Thanks for having me. It was nuts because, you know, I'm just this, you know, 20-odd-year-old person from Washington, D.C. I don't know a thing about business, and I really do not expect to be treated like a VIP. So, you know, I go to this trade show expecting to be in the audience and listen to esteemed speakers, and then they escort me onto the stage, and it turns out I am the esteemed speaker, and everybody speaks only Chinese, so I have to come up with something to say in Chinese. So I kind of stumble out a few words, and all of the factory managers, like 300 people stand there clapping, and I look at them in their slightly tattered jackets and sweaters, and I realize, well, they're actually more nervous than I am. So I calm down, I say my few words, and then I go through the audience looking at their exhibits of, you know, transistors and apple seeds and some special type of herbal medicine and, you know, basically stuff, you know, I learned the term for motherboard. I didn't even know what it was in English. And I look at all this stuff and I think to myself, what do you expect me to do? But then I realize it doesn't matter. I'm the avatar of Western business and investment, and that's all they need.
This is the second decade of the Chinese miracle. Anne was fortunate enough to experience the first decade as an editorialist. 1985 is my memory, Anne. And you were there working on a magazine that was vastly overstaffed, China Pictorial, vastly overstaffed. You give us an image of a culture that is about as far from capitalism as we can imagine. The employees slept on their desks. Those who were lucky enough got a cold water flat or something near to. The health care, the housing and the food were all free, so they were given a meager allotment to buy cigarettes. And everybody was dressed the same. Is that correct in 1985?
That's right, John. It was quite a shock, that office. Everybody who is unmarried, so basically anyone under 30, lived in the office and slept on top of their desk. And I'd come in the morning. I think I began at 8 o'clock, and people would be walking up and down the halls with these tin enamel cups, holding their toothbrushes, and because that's where they had slept. And there were all these employees who hadn't really had jobs sometimes for decades. Like there was a whole industry Indonesian section that had actually been, they had halted the Indonesian version of the magazine 15 years earlier, but the people were still there. One of them was psychotic, actually. We called him Crazy Wu, and he would walk up and down the aisles, the hall, kicking the baseboards. He drove his office mate crazy because in the cold winter, he would open all the windows and turn on a fan because he didn't feel cold. And in the summer, he'd insist on closing the windows. Crazy Wu, but, you know, employed for 15 years. He, in the end, he died of gangrene on the street.
We're looking at a China that doesn't have any connection to the one in 1994. Something happened in those, what, eight, nine years. And what was happening was something called capital roaders, the capital roaders associated with a man, Deng Xiaoping, who after Mao Zedong's death from old age and dementia, there was a disruption, the Gang of Four, and Deng Xiaoping got out of jail. He'd been imprisoned as a challenge to Mao's power. Deng had a vision. What was it, Anne? And how does that vision translate from that China pictorial strangeness into the presentation you made in 1994? What did Deng do?
Well, I think it was the opening of the economy was slowly creeping up. You were starting to see these little, you know, these little markets open on the streets and people start to do things that had that they had not done during the Maoist era. The real change, I think, started in 1979 because Deng Xiaoping was invited to the United States to visit then President Carter. And he couldn't find any hard money to pay for hotels and meals in the United States. And he realized with his bureaucracy, we got to start bringing in some hard money because the renminbi then could not be used and still cannot be used internationally. So they needed U.S. dollars. So they started an export economy.
Yes, you give us the odd fact that he looked for all the hard money in China and they could only come up with $38,000, which had to pay for the whole entourage when he went to the United States. Now, he needs hard money. Is that the motive for the transformation of Guangdong province into an export superstar to find
that was the
money?
Initial motive. So initially, you know, there were a lot of people in China who were very hesitant about the sort of moral and spiritual pollution that would be created by intermingling with foreigners. So Deng's compromise was to create these special zones that were dedicated to export for foreign companies so they would have immediate access to foreign markets. They would bring in foreign currency, but you weren't allowed in them unless you worked there if you were Chinese or you showed a passport if you were foreign. So they were sort of hermetically sealed, and Shenzhen was the first of those and became the most successful.
There were industries that initially did very well exporting, textiles and garments, I have from your notes, Anne, but you spent some time telling us how the media transformed itself in this period. I love the idea that the first 500 words of an essay in the old way had to list the names of the dignitaries who were part of this story. So you didn't have any news whatsoever. You just had them in what? In chronological order or in order of their superiority?
Rank order of importance. You still do that in China with the official newspapers, and it is intensely boring. But there are people dedicated to studying that stuff to see who's up and who's down bureaucratically.
But what was going on was what you identify as a fusion of those who were running companies and those who had political power. They weren't the same person at this time. What, they have conversations, they develop together?
Well, what happened in order to create this elite class of people with money and power and political power was that they gradually separated the allocation of money from ministries to separate organizations. And these initially were started by very well-connected people because the bureaucracy was anxious about it. So you had the first venture capital fund that was started by Deng Xiaoping's daughter with some other, you know, the daughters and sons of other high officials, and they would allocate money to start up companies that were not connected to ministries. So this was the first wave. And, you know, you had to be, the bureaucracy was very nervous about this sort of thing. So they wanted connected people they could trust to be in charge of it.
Yes, let us turn to the red capitalist period, which is really sons and daughters period. The book is Wild Ride, A Short History of the Opening and Closing of the Chinese Economy. And Stevenson Yang is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Hey, guys. Finding the perfect gift for the food lover in your life is easy, thanks to Goldbelly. Goldbelly ships America's most iconic foods straight from world-famous restaurants right to your door. So if you want to treat someone to Joe's Stone Crab from Miami, Franklin Barbecue from Texas, or desserts from famous foodies like Ina Garten or Martha Stewart, Goldbelly has you covered with free shipping anywhere in the country. Just go to goldbelly.com and for a limited time, get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's promo code GIFT.
Hey guys, have you heard of Goldbelly? It's this amazing site where they ship the most iconic, famous foods from restaurants across the country, anywhere, nationwide. I've never found a more perfect gift than food. Goldbelly ships Chicago deep dish pizza, New York bagels, Maine lobster rolls, and even Ina Garten's famous cakes. So, if you're looking for a gift for the food lover in your life, head to goldbelly.com and get 20% off your first order with promo code GIFT. That's goldbelly.com, promo code GIFT.